You're tuned to Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, or possibly streaming at WBAI.org on the web. My name is Robert Knight, and we've been celebrating the life and music of Phil Oakes today. There But For Fortune, that is actually the name of the new wonderful documentary that's produced by his brother Michael Oakes and directed by Kenneth Bowser. Both of them were in our studios today, and we had the honor of interviewing them on 5 o'clock shadow. We heard some of that, along with the legendary Bob Fass, who was also a part of that program. Let me point out that Bob will be doing his own show on the film and his actual encounters and conspiracies with Phil Oakes 24 hours from now on Radio Unnameable with Bob Fass on WBAI. And I cannot highly enough recommend that you see this film. It just premiered right here today in New York, where Flokes spent so much of his life. It's at the corner of 6th Avenue and West 3rd Street, or if you take the IND, it's the West 4th Street stop. 323 6th Avenue at the intersection of 3rd Street. It's the IFC, Independent Film Center. And the first day is pretty much sold out, but now you can call area code 212-924-7771. 212-924-7771, the Independent Film Center, and check out this great new movie, Phil Oakes, There But For Fortune. Or you can click online at ifccenter.com. But Flokes is part of our culture here at WBAI and part of our life in liberation. And so we were very, very happy to have the opportunity to take another look at a wonderful life. And speaking of wonderful, do stay tuned, because a wonderful program is just about to follow this one. It is, of course, Hour of the Wolf with yet another BAI legend, Jim Freund. For Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight. Stay tuned.
Okay, I mean, and with, thank you, Robert, with words like that, okay. Now, I didn't even know about this movie, all right? I saw a review of it today in the New York Times. I have read Death of a Rebel, which was one of the Phil Oakes biographies. And I went to a number of Phil Oakes concerts. My brother was he was of the age. I was a little bit young when I started here at WBAI, where I was certainly listening to Oakes on the air a lot. I was 13. So, you know, a little precocious in 1967 and all that. But I loved the music. And in them days, many people were divided into two camps. There were the people who thought that Dylan was the best, and there were people who thought that Oakes was the best. I was of the latter camp. But, you know, it didn't matter. It doesn't mean you don't like Dylan. It just means that Oakes, to me, with songs like Crucifixion and Changes, did anybody notice that the last episode of Hour of the Wolf, during the Hour of the Wolf, the last song played on that program was Changes by Phil Oakes? But I had no idea that this movie was opening. I'm very pleased to hear how successful it is, and I have every intention to go see it. Oh, want to talk about movies? Stay tuned. But I do have to tell one story, which is that the WBAI Free Music Store was, yeah, the John and Genevieve look at each other going, yeah, like Freund's not going to tell a story. So the WBAI Free Music Store was our concert series. I was the door gnome. That was my official title. And I would do the door. And Dave Van Ronk and Pat Skye were doing a concert. I wonder where these tapes are. And usually the idea that Phil Oakes would be there was like legendary. This was important. And I was asked by a couple of people, you keep this guy out. And I was aghast. This is the legend. This is Phil Oakes. And I said hello to him, and he said, Phil Oakes is dead. I am John Train. Well, apparently this is all covered in the movie, but and people say, well, I don't know about the primary source materials. But I'm telling the story. This is a first-hand story. Now, of course, my memory and God knows what my state of sobriety may have been at that moment. I think the colors were really good. But nevertheless, I was assigned to take Oaks to the nearby coffee shop and do what I could to see that he was okay. And I got him back in time. People were running to and from. We were on ground level in those days in the WBAI church on 62nd Street just off First. The coffee shop was cornered First. And I got signals through the window. It's like, okay, concert is over. It's time for the encores. Bring him in for the encores. And he didn't sing any of his classic songs, but he did perform at the end, but I didn't really understand a lot what was going on other than he was being satirical or something, calling himself John Train. Well, what we now know is that he was in a deep, deep, deep state of mental depression, what people would call insanity. And oh yes, about 2 months later, he hung himself. So, you know, this is the totality of my Phil Oakes experience, aside from hearing from my brother. My brother went to the Gold Lamé Suit concert where at Carnegie Hall, where Oakes, who was unable to become as big as he wanted to, donned an Elvis outfit. You know, and this is a folky. And he did Carnegie Hall, and he wore an Elvis outfit, and he was booed off the stage. I mean, this is amazing stuff. Anyway, that's for another show. This morning, we have guests. I think it's time to start this show. Yes, indeed. 30 caps of psilocybin. This is WBAI in New York City. You figure it out. Listeners, no, it's an old, old story. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. I don't have announcements to make. Yes, I know I cut the theme in half, but it's an abbreviated show, and I already blew 5 minutes of it. So we would get to it. So what announcements are there? There's no, the Nursef reading was last night, and I would say it was well attended. There were somewhere between, I'd say, 75 and 85 people in attendance, which is pretty good for that space. We used to be in a much larger space, and it was, you know, it looked like we wouldn't have any people. You go to KGB. KGB had, you know, 50 people fills it up. And they normally draw, what would you say, about 70? I would guess, yes, this matters to me. I sit there and count. So does Matt. So, you know, Ellen is just like, it is what it is. But, you know, Matt and I are always going, wow. And so they're always cool. They've always got this really great crowd. I think of the KGB reading series as a salon, where ours is sort of a performance, which I think is a fair, and actually I work to make that way. I work to make it a different thing. Our next Nursef reading will be, health permitting, Samuel R. Delaney and Andrea Hairston. And I won't tell you the date, because the date is likely to change in order to accommodate Andrea's teaching schedule. She teaches on Tuesday nights, so we're probably going to move to a Thursday. So KGB isn't for another couple of weeks, and I don't know, but at the last KGB, a frequent visitor to this program said, oh, by the way, I'm leaving New York.
I don't know who you mean, Jim. Oh, me?
That would be you, John. And in like 3 days.
Yep.
Or
yep.
4 days, yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But depending on whether this is Wednesday or Thursday.
Right.
It's fair to call it a Wednesday night show.
Yeah, so 4 days, the 10th. The 10th is the day.
Yeah. So, John Joseph Adams is an editor, a publicist, not yet a publisher, right? You're not
right.
Really?
Yeah. No, I'm not a publisher. No,
it could happen.
Someday,
yeah.
Maybe.
Pull the mic closer to you, sorry. By the way. That's all right. Yeah, it's impotent. This is the professionalism of WBAI here. Those who are watching the show on video got that. Anyway.
Wait, there's video? I didn't know that.
If there's video, we are in trouble. Yes.
Also with us, Genevieve Valentine, soon to be novelist.
That's correct, in May.
In May. And you'll be back on then.
I hope so.
Yes, I
trust. Depends on how tonight goes.
depends on whether I'm still on then. Well, you know, people are going, oh yeah, all these program changes happen, and they assume that this is the end of it. No. The program director said that he was going to change all the programming in March.
We better party it up tonight, then.
I think so. I think so. A party like it's 1999 or something. I don't know. That's the last century. It's the last millennium, as a matter of fact. But we're at the start. This is the first show of a new decade, as a matter of fact.
It is.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, it really is. So, John is also a podcaster with Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, which is really, by the way, a lot of fun and really lives up to its name, except for the fact that if you're truly a geek, why aren't you in Las Vegas? Because it's expensive is the answer.
Okay.
Yeah. You yelled at him about going to the coast. You can't yell at him about not being
there. One is visiting. The other is...
Oh, you
leaving.
Mean why am I not in Las Vegas now? Because of the convention. I see.
The
consumer... I wasn't following you there, Jim.
Yeah,
he thinks you're a really good gambler is where I was going.
Yes, I was like, exactly. Are you making some sort of reference to like the geeks that bites the heads off chickens? Or like, is there some sort of carnival in Vegas? I don't understand.
If you look at the front page of the New York Times...
Yes, right.
You will see that the Consumer Electronics Show is there.
The New York Times comes in pages?
Screens. No, but then there's not a front page, is there? Okay. I'm using an app. I just use an app for it. And that's a problem because I don't know whether the stories I'm reading in the Times are that day's or the previous weekend because you don't get exactly the same kind of thing. I do not think I have actually gotten my fingers dirty with print in a while. I still read The New Yorker in print, even though I have a digital subscription. But the Times, I read digitally. But I try to check the bylines.
Technology never goes the way you think it's gonna.
Yeah. And also, we have at least two of our comrades, at least two, Tempest Bradford covers for Laptop Magazine, and Barbara Krasnoff is for Computer World Magazine. And we won't discuss Pornell. first time I met Pornell was at a computer trade show. It was not in science fiction circles. It didn't improve things. Anyway.
In defense of my geekhood, I do enjoy technology, but we don't cover technology stuff as part of the Geeks Galaxy and on the show. So I have no professional obligations to go to such a show, and thus would
Oh yeah, but the number of science fiction fans and readers and stuff who attend such a show,
yeah, no, I'm sure it's
alarmingly
very high, yeah.
Yeah, especially in the press room. Mm-hmm. Which is all that I would ever go when I went there. Mm-hmm. And main reason for me to go to Las Vegas, to see the penguins. Mm. I'm serious. You go to Las Vegas, there's a memorial to Bugsy Siegel, right?
Of course.
The Flamingo Hotel. Mm-hmm. Because what other city would have a memorial to a serial killer? And right next to it is an enclosure of penguins in the middle of the Mojave Desert. I kid you not. And I'm a big penguin fan for... Most people know this. I like stuffed penguins. I like movies of penguins. I just like penguins. Linux, mm-hmm. good operating system because it has a penguin. I actually became a Linux editor at internet.com. I was the Linux editor because they saw all those penguins on my desk and assumed that meant I knew Linux.
There you go.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Linux, of course, was largely developed by science fiction fans. Eric S. Raymond and Richard Stallman.
How many penguins are we talking about?
At my house?
No, in the enclosure in Vegas.
probably about 20. They have 3 or 4 keepers, all from Hawaii.
Do they all look bewildered? I mean, I guess they all look bewildered anyway. They're a very solemn bird.
Well, yeah, I mean, no, penguins are always bewildered. That's what they do. Yeah, you know, they're either ecstatic or bewildered, or usually both.
It's a short life, but a fun one if you're a mm-hmm. penguin.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you live for the krill, the joy of the krill. Anyway.
Have you seen that YouTube video that's been circulating lately? It's like
about the world's happiest penguin.
Well, is it the do you mean the penguin that's like sort of freaking out to the death metal? Is that what you mean?
Technically to the snow. But yes, death metal.
Well, yeah, but they have the death metal soundtrack over it.
Well, no, I saw the version before somebody put the music over it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a very happy-looking penguin, but I like it with the death metal background.
Jim liked happy penguin before he was metal.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, basically. Somebody put it on my Facebook page. So, you know, what can I say? I think it's pretty high up there on my Facebook page now, but because guy keeps reposting it and all that. And, you know, I put up a sign that says, you know, on tonight's show there's this, and I'm glad that it's at the top of the page, right? And then... 8 people put other things on my wall, putting the promotion that I'm trying to do on Facebook all the way. But it doesn't matter now. You don't have a regular ongoing status that people can look at what you're doing at that moment anymore.
Facebook is going to the dogs.
Facebook was never above the dogs.
Oh, snap.
it's Facebook is the new AOL. I despise AOL. Mm.
The Social Network was a very good movie, though. Did you see that?
I have not yet seen
it. Oh, it's really good.
I have a copy at home, and I have still not seen it. Now let's get this straight. We have an important editor of science fiction, which includes Lightspeed mm-hmm. and...
Well, I also edit Fantasy Magazine now as well. Magazine and Lightspeed, and I've edited a number of anthologies. You know, Brave New World, which you've got a copy of there.
Most recently, Brave New Worlds, plural.
Brave New Worlds, right, that came out just this month. And prior to that, I had Way of the Wizard in October or November.
November.
Yeah, you came on the show, I think, last for the Sherlock Holmes anthology.
Yeah, and actually I had another anthology between that, too. Living Dead 2 came out in September.
Right.
So,
And we did a Nirsif reading for The Living Dead 1.
Right.
Which David Bart Kirtley has done what is clearly the coolest poster ever had.
Yeah, that was a pretty epic poster.
Yeah, it really was. Whoa, what did I hit? Do you hear a low thrumming noise? Oh, no, you're not wearing headphones. I hit some button by accident.
Punk.
Ah, there. It's just this little chromium switch here. Anyway, that was on the air, wasn't it? Wow. that's so good. I've been doing this for years, so I know what I'm doing. Not. It was a great poster. Yeah. They took the South Street Seaport where we were holding the readings at the time and just put the zombies exactly into the location.
Yeah.
I guess coming at the reader, but coming out of the reading or something like that. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
So we have this editor, writer, et cetera, et cetera. We have in Genevieve a really, like, writer. You were on the show not long after one of your first publications. Isn't that true?
I think the first reading I ever did was reading from John Joseph Adams' anthology, Federations.
And that was a classic reading. That was really good.
Well, thank
you. That was really good. Good anthology as well.
Thank you.
I love, by the way, as a person who, in olden days, Hour of the Wolf, I didn't have as many guests. I used to come when the show was 5 days a week. Much of it, once a week, was just me reading a story on the air where I would actually perform, which is actually what I did last week. And my first such show in a long time where I would read. And what I live for are theme anthologies because I would be at home saying, what do I want to do? Let's see. Unicorns. Yes, Gardner Does One, Jack Dan have an anthology based on unicorns or whatever. And these are the kinds of books, the theme anthologies that John is turning out. And they are my favorite kind of anthologies because, you know, you can have a shelf and you can determine the topic, not the mood, because there's always a breadth. And we should just, you know, take pause and just mention some of the people who share the table of contents with Genevieve Valentine include somebody named Shirley Jackson, Ray Bradbury, Scott Card, Philip K. Dick, Neil Gaiman, Kurt Vonnegut, Ursula K. Le Guin, a couple of okay newbies.
They show promise.
A lot of those are obviously reprints, or else this is the third zombie book. It's one of the two.
You know, actually, everything in there is a reprint.
Everything.
Yeah, no originals this time around. It's the first book I've done, I think, that actually has no originals in it. Every other time I had done one of these anthologies that was primarily reprints, I intended it to be entirely reprints. It's just that, you know, an original story always snuck into it somehow. Like, in two cases, John Langan said, hey, I haven't written a story in that theme, but how about I write you something new? And I'm like, well, yeah, that would be awesome. I mean,
it's
love
not just
stuff,
a marketing thing. It's also
right.
that people are forcing themselves on you, and who are you to say no?
Right. I mean, you know, I have a budget to work with, and if they're willing to send me an original story for that, then, yeah, I mean, I'm happy to consider it.
So now that the show's almost a third over, let me explain what we're going to do. We're not going to talk about movies. Genevieve is just a way cool blogger, by the way, about films. The two people who I read about films regularly online are Roger Ebert. There are a lot of fake Eberts out there, which is why his Twitter feed is like Ebert Chicago or something like that, so that, you know, that's actually him. And Genevieve Valentine, because you have a unique take on films, and you cover movies that nobody has heard of, which I like.
For their own good, usually.
Usually, but you know, I there are a certain number of films. Oh, I have to tell listeners, by the way, that at an event that I hosted at my house actually last month, where you were in attendance, and John was unable to go. Danny Lieberman gave me a copy of a film I've been seeking for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And it is, I have yet to watch it since I last saw it, but it is, I think, one of the most faithful, next to Scanner Darkly, the most faithful Philip K. Dick movie ever made, and nobody has heard of this film. It's called Barjo.
You mentioned it to me, but I have not seen
You've not seen it. Okay, so I can actually, like, trump you on this.
Oh, it's shocking what people can trump me on. I think I have spent my life watching the movies that no one else has seen and none of the movies that I actually should have seen. Or they happened so long ago that they've faded out of memory.
But this is an unknown film.
I believe you.
But it's not a bad film. That's the problem. It doesn't fit your criteria.
It's sad. Good films rarely do. There's only so much you can say about a good movie.
Yeah.
There's plenty to say about a movie that sucks.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's like you can who was it? Janet Maslin. It was like if a movie was good, I wouldn't bother reading her review. If it was really bad, you knew that Janet Maslin was just, you know, that her pen was warmed in hell, that everything was all set to go, and that you were going to get a joy out of Manola Darkus is like this as well, occasionally. Just every so often, a movie comes along that is so bad that it gets ripped to shreds.
I know one of those movies.
Pray tell, what is this legacy of which you speak?
On our way here, John and I stopped by a movie theater, ill-advisedly, and saw Tron Legacy.
I told you could come to the station early, but no.
But no. No, we had to plunk down almost $20 a piece to watch.
Oh my
what
God!
It was ridiculous, especially considering the movie was beyond the sort of bad that is campy. Beyond the sort of bad where you can snicker and enjoy.
It wasn't campy bad. It wasn't like toke up bad.
Two moments of camp, both of which are due to delightful British actors, one of which is Michael Sheen.
Oh, I love Michael Sheen.
But he's engaged in a ham-off with someone. In the last 6 or 7 movies he's been in, he waltzes in, delivers the worst possible performance on purpose, and waltzes back out. It's like he wants to see how many movies he can be in for one scene only.
As a former talent residuals clerk at an agency, did he get paid? Anyway.
Rent has to be paid. I understand this. He understands this, but...
Although you would think Michael Sheen wouldn't have to work hard. You know, you record another 8 audiobooks, do...
I feel like after Underworld Rise of the Lycans, you really have to consider how much other camp you were willing to set up with.
He was in that?
Oh my God, he had sex on the edge of a cliff.
But was he in the movie? Never mind.
Oh no. And the other one was James Frain, who I don't think anybody else knows, but he played the sycophantic second-in-command to the bad guy. And was delightful in it. And the last thing he was in was The Tudors. And he started out in
Edith
Wharton miniseries. He was Cromwell.
Oh, my. Okay.
He was Cromwell. He has been in a million good things, doing a fantastic job. And in this one, he has a powdered white face, has shaved his head, and has a helmet that covers from the top of his skull to the bottom of his nose in a line right about the eye width apart. It was... God awful! Just
so,
the entire thing.
I mean, I love ripping movies apart, and this is the radio station of the legendary Paul Wonder. Now, for those who don't know, Paul Wonder, was an ops director here at WBAI, and he was a critic who got quoted on every bad movie. You know, my favorite film of the year, Paul Wonder, WBAI. It was so ubiquitous that Jay Leno started a routine saying, "Who the is Paul Wonder?" You know, and we're all sitting there in the den with Paul going, "It's this guy right here." What people don't get is Paul loved these movies. Yeah, you know, one of his favorite movies was Dr. Butcher, MD. And the slogan of the movie is, "The doctor is insane."
Hey, that's just a classic. There's no arguing that tagline.
Yeah, no. Great taglines, yes, but he would try to make us watch this movie. Oh, you're going to love this. No, I don't like gory films. I don't like good gory films. I don't want to see The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I'm willing to accept may be a great movie. I know I would probably like the film, but I can only take so much rape and dismemberment and all that before it causes me enough sleepless nights that I say it wasn't worth losing the sleep for 2 hours of provocative entertainment.
If you need to get to sleep, Tron Legacy is a pretty good way to go about it.
Yeah, it gets too loud. Paul was able, he'd go to Rambo and fall asleep. You know, Paul was able to all these things. They did an expose of Paul Wonder on 60 Minutes. Trying to find out what the payoffs were. They did a secret camera and filmed him at the Four Seasons being taken out to dinner and wined and dined by the producers. And Paul's reaction to that is, did they bother mentioning that I panned that movie? The problem is Paul loved bad films, and he didn't do too many negative reviews because he thought that wasn't his job. His job was to guide people to good movies. You know, but good movies are movies that he liked.
So admirable in its way, but dangerous.
Yeah. There were blogs written about Paul, about, you know, how real movie critics met Satan incarnate. That was Paul. He was our good friend. He's dead now 11 years. Really sad. He lived for the bad loving movie critic. But there's the difference. You don't love bad films.
Occasionally I will. Occasionally I will watch one and think, this is a terrible movie that I have to own immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're watching Tron Legacy, it's a bunch of dialogue that feels like it came out of a magic eight ball where there's no internal logic nor sentence logic. I mean, a sentence would start one way and a completely different way, had nothing to do with the plot. And at the end of it, Jeff Bridges would go, right, dude?
Yeah, it's like he was
the Big Lebowski.
Yeah, it's like he was playing the dude in Tron. It's like we were discussing this. I was like, I said to Genevieve during the movie, like, I feel bad for Jeff Bridges. Like, why is he?
He lost a bet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was like,
Probably contractually obligated if you think about it, because he's the star of the original film.
Well, not contractually obligated. He could say no, and then they just couldn't do the movie or something.
They
right?
CGI'd his face for 2/3 of the time he was on screen anyway.
Yeah, and it was horrible. It's like this whole movie is like special effects, right? And then one of the major things that they're doing in the movie, it's terrible. It's like, you know, okay.
I have heard from everybody who has.
Oh my God. It does not matter how true to life your 3D holographic nonsense gladiator rings are. If every time the Jeff Bridges CGI shows up on screen, you crack up because he looks like Woody in the first Toy Story.
Yes. You know, he looks so fake. It's like, I mean, you know, we were talking about how, you know, that the Benjamin Button movie a couple of years ago, you know, they digitally, youthened Brad Pitt. And as I recall, that looked pretty good.
That wasn't bad.
I mean, that was a couple of years ago. And then now today's, you know, movie that we saw today, the Jeff Bridges, like, it looks so fake. I mean, it's obviously fake every minute you're looking at it.
It looks a little weird in X-Men, which is the first film that I really remember, where they were doing flashback with Patrick Stewart and right. Ian McKellen, where, you know, this is, you know, 30, 40 years earlier. And they had the grace to only make it about 30 seconds long.
Mm.
So, and to keep quick cutting so that your eyes weren't accustomed to how it didn't work.
For some reason, I feel like it's worse in Tron Legacy, both because of the sheer amount of time it's on screen, so you have ample opportunity to look at it and be creeped out. But also because actual Jeff Bridges is looking pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, they grayed up his hair and everything, but, you know, he has good bone structure. The man is aging well. All it would take was a little Vaseline on the lens and he'd look 30 again. But instead, we get this...
The Guccione effect, yes.
Yes, the abhorrent, uncanny valley of looking at something and saying, did they mean for it to be this bad?
Yeah.
Well, I am quite willing to go and see Jeff Bridges in True Grit. Which I've still not seen. Right. I loved the first movie. I really did. I'm a big fan of that. And I love the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm. The Coen brothers can really knock it out of the park.
They really do. They really do. And the novel came out in 68.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it 8 or 9 times. And I saw the movie frequently. And whenever it's on TCM or... and I'll say, well, just watch this scene. And then... I'm hooked. I'm just watching the whole movie all the way through again. And what I have seen of the new film...
It looks fantastic.
It looks incredible. And when you hear that the Coen brothers are remaking True Grit as they once remade The Lady Killers, one of the great films of all time originally, my thought is, why? Why are you remaking this?
And 9 times out of 10, you can ask that about anything and it's true. But then the Coen brothers get a hold of it, and you're like, let's see.
Yeah.
We will see.
But you see, there's a reason why I resent their doing remakes and other films. Because
it encourages everyone else?
Well, it's just that they're so brilliant, I think, right? I mean, they're you want to see something new come from them because
I have a title in mind that they own. Mm. The secret Yiddish. What's the title? The Chabon film.
Oh, yeah, right. The
Yiddish Policeman's Union?
Yiddish Policeman's Union, yeah.
They own that. Why isn't that being made?
And they'll get around to it.
Yeah, but that's the film that they will do that I will be amazed by. I'm amazed by most of
their films.
You haven't
seen True Grit yet. You don't know what will amaze you.
Actually, I've small screen. Very small screen. But I think I have it with me. But I won't watch it that way. I want to see it on the big screen because that's how they filmed it. They used their regular cinematographer, whose name I don't recall. I'm not a true cineast. I just know they have their cinematographer, and they know how to film stuff. So I want to see it that way.
I think Westerns you're obligated to.
Yeah.
Like there's something about a Western that just begs for you to see it on
at least modern Westerns, yeah. you know, it really does. Well, actually, or an old John Ford. I mean, The Iron Horse, and I'm talking about, what is that, 1924, 25, John Ford movie, you don't want to see it on a small screen. It the panorama is fabulous. And by the way, great movie. 3 hours, but hey, it goes quickly.
It's worth it.
It is. You know the film.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, again, that's an obscure one. Not many people know that one.
And it's soon to be joined in the amazing cowboy lexicon by Cowboys and Aliens.
I have tremors about that.
Are you clutching your pearls?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. If I had poils, I'd be clutching them.
The saddest thing about it is that of the 8 or 9 previews they showed before we actually got to see the cinematic gem that is Tron Legacy, it was the best one.
Oh, yeah.
It was the only one that was not a remake of something else or a sequel to something else.
But I saw that trailer. I don't remember what movie it preceded when I did. But what I then read from the publicity department is that the publicity department was very, very worried because people were cheering and clapping, and apparently it also went over really well at Comic-Con and all that. And the director was getting in touch with the publicity department and saying, you understand that this is in no way, shape, or form a comedy. It's not supposed to be camp. It's a dead serious movie.
Isn't the director John Favreau?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't get to say that.
No, he shouldn't. He, of all people.
Of all people, John Favreau does not get to demand that people take him seriously as a filmmaker.
And you don't call your movie Cowboys and Aliens if you don't want to be able to assume it's that. When I first heard of it, I mean, first of all, I actually assumed it was animated. I thought it was going to be like a Pixar-style animation because I was like, Cowboys and Aliens, how else are they going to do it, you know? And
I actually thought that they were ripping off another filmmaker. Who's making? Well, it was Cowboys and Dinosaurs, really, but then aliens get involved as well. And this is a movie that was either planned or made by J.T. Petty, who does interesting, low budget, mostly stuff I can't see because he loves his gore. Mm-hmm. I want to see his films. Actually, I should see the one that he made. He made a documentary recently, right? That came out. About the history of horror film and Lovecraft and stuff like that. He's been on the show about 3 or 4 times.
And you can't watch his movies?
I can't watch a number of
his. What do you talk about?
He talk about the books he has written.
Well, there you go.
He has, hey, Tony. He's got several books about, not about anything. He has a series of books about werepumpkins. They're kids' books.
I did not know that.
That's kind of awesome, actually.
And I believe it is through those books that he met his wife, Sarah Langan.
Mm-hmm.
And I have had them... Oh, you didn't know that. And I have had them on together. And they read together at a NIRSIF about a year ago.
I think I was at that NIRSIF.
I think you were. No, actually, he came... You know what it was? Is that she couldn't show up. He read. And she was sick as a dog. She couldn't make it. It was like a year ago, November. But then she read on her own, and he was there for that. But now he's very busy. His films have been doing well. The Burrowers.
That's right.
The Burrowers did good business at like the Toronto Film Festival, and actually got picked up for distribution. It didn't go straight to video. It actually got play.
So now you can not watch it on the big screen?
Yeah, and I want to see it because it's got Clancy Brown in it. Anybody know Clancy Brown?
How do you not know Clancy Brown?
Mr. Krabs! did you see the TV series Carnival?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course.
He's the preacher bad guy. That's kind of
He was also in The Bride with Jennifer Beals and Sting.
That's right.
And
not
he played
about
Vincent, the monster, whose name means he will win.
And isn't he in The Highlander?
Oh, God.
The original Highlander?
Yeah, isn't he?
Sean Connery? He might be.
Yeah, isn't he the bad guy?
This is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, probably was. Probably was.
Huh?
It's a hole in my education. Have I seen the terrible TV series full of houseboats in Paris for no reason? Never seen the movie.
Wow.
I've seen the series, not the movie.
Huh.
Yeah, and he does an incredible amount of voiceover work.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he's most importantly Mr. Krabs and SpongeBob SquarePants. He is. It's, you know, just yet you think, of course, the guy who's, you know, the bad guy in Carnival would have to be Mr. Krabs.
Hmm.
What other choice could there have been? Typecasting.
None. No choice.
I don't know. And he has, and he did the lead in J.T. Petty's last film.
Hmm.
So, and J.T. was talking and talked on the air considerably about a movie that would feature cowboys and aliens. And he did that about 4 or 5 years ago. Now, I'm not saying. And I really doubt that. However, it's you know, the idea had been worked on, and he would have done it. And actually, he told a little bit about the movie on the air, about the premise of the film.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what was the film that JT was going to remake? Is it something like Faces of Death 5 or something? Do you know about this? This is like supposed to be the goriest, most horrific.
Okay,
people
now
think,
I'm clutching my pearls. I can't.
Yeah.
I can't. No horror.
I can't even really talk about it. But there are people here at WBAI, like Max Schmid, who think that, who's absolutely convinced that parts of this movie were real. And I had him talking to J.T. Petty. And, well, J.T. was horrified that Max would think that any of that was real.
For Cowboys and Aliens, the guy in front of us, after the preview was over, everyone laughed, of course, when there was bemused silence right up until the title came up, and then everyone
there
laughed.
There can't be a spoiler in a trailer, so just...
Well, no. There are a bunch of cowboys, and then aliens show up. The entire audience doesn't know what they're looking at. They think it's one of those please don't text during the movie ads. And then it comes up, cowboys and aliens. Everyone laughs, everyone claps. Every time I have seen this preview, that is exactly what happens.
And then
guy sitting in front of us said, well, I like cowboys and I like aliens. I guess I'll see that. And I was like, this is exactly how this movie got made.
Yeah, that's it. That's
like,
it.
Like two guys got high as kites, sat down, and were like, okay, what are two things that we like? And peanut butter and jelly and golf did not make a compelling movie, but cowboys and aliens happened to.
Okay.
And
Sam, is there anything but testosterone in this film? Is there a
There's
woman
Olivia Wilde.
Oh, now she's becoming ubiquitous. She left House and now she's in everything.
Because she's slightly more talented than Megan Fox, but similar features.
Oh, that's not fair. That's not fair. I loved her on House. Megan Fox could appear on House as...
a corpse.
That's exactly the word I was thinking of.
I'm pretty sure Cowboys and Aliens is actually based on a graphic novel.
I think that's right.
I mean, they may have come up with a graphic novel by doing the, you know, two guys who are high in a room thing. That may have how the graphic novel came up, but...
So. Yeah.
We'll go with that.
Yeah, I think it's quite possible. But Jon Favreau, lost all cred after... But, I mean, he does fun bad. He really does. It could be that when he was saying, but this is a serious film, he may have been talking with his tongue in cheek.
Why would you tell your publicist that, though? You don't want the publicist...
To get it in the papers. because that's where I got it from.
No one goes to a Jon Favreau film looking for any kind of serious cinema whatsoever. They go to a Jon Favreau film looking for a lot of action, a lot of running from things that have an enormous subwoofer component, and then a few intentional or otherwise hilarious moments. No one goes to a Jon Favreau film thinking, I will finally have to sit down and confront my own humanity.
Yeah. Yes, right, exactly. What other films are on the horizon that you want to comment on?
We had both the Green Lantern and the Green Hornet trailers, which I think is unfair. You should only have to sit through one.
Yeah.
Making us sit through them both is just appalling.
Was there an ad for Green Planet? No.
The Green Lantern trailer is so abysmal. It's just like, oh my God. It's just like...
I thought I didn't know what to think because I really, really, really want to like that. I want Paul Witkover to cover the film for me, by the way, because he knows everything there is to know about all facets of the Green Lantern. He is...
Well, Almost none of which look like they're going to be in the actual film. It's mostly Blake Lively pretending she's a pilot. And Ryan Reynolds showing off how often he went to the gym.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate because I know Ryan Reynolds is capable of actually acting if he puts his mind to it, but that movie is just not the way.
I know, in the trailer, oh my God, he looks like completely like blank-faced almost in every frame. It's just like, it's just, he's not, the camera's on his face and he's not doing anything. He's just looking at things.
And you think that's really terrible, and then you see the Green Hornet trailer and realize, we need to go back to the Green Lantern. I'm sorry. I judged it too harshly because I didn't realize how bad the Green Hornet looked. This was my first time seeing the Green Hornet trailer. I had avoided it entirely.
Yeah, and that's opening like within a week or something like that. So news should be out.
No, Green Lantern's not opening.
Green Lantern's
like
Green Lantern's a summer movie. Green Hornet is being buried in early January.
Well, thank God. I didn't want to wait.
In fact, they're probably showing it at CES this week, in all seriousness.
They
do that a lot. I when I used to go to Comdex, which was the computer version, to the side of the Consumer Electronics Show when Comdex was the big deal, Bond films that hadn't yet opened were being shown at, you know, a Microsoft party or something like that.
Did they lock you in a room? Because that's the only way they're going to get anyone to watch Green Hornet.
it looks... I'm talking, you know, it was so long ago that it was still Pierce Brosnan. When I saw, that's not that long ago.
That wasn't that long ago.
No, but it wasn't like his last outing. It was the one with Terry Hatcher.
Which is not as bad as the one that came after it, so we'll give it a pass.
Yeah, I know. It's too bad because I wanted to really like Pierce Brosnan after he got screwed out of the role because of Remington Steele.
I maintain that GoldenEye is one of the best Bond outings.
Actually, it is. It's very good and directed by the same guy who directed Casino Royale. Mm-hmm. People say, oh, my God, what a reboot. You know, the whole Daniel Craig thing.
He knows exactly how to balance it.
He really does. Yep. And I thought Casino Royale was a good...
It's excellent.
Okay, but here's the problem. I liked both of them.
Well, you must leave. You must leave at once.
Thank you. Yeah, you can engineer. Oh. It's not hard. But, and actually, of course, the first that I'm referring to is really the second because, of course, the first... was a TV show starring Barry, an American. Jim Bond was played by Barry Sullivan? Peter Lorre played the chief.
Good God.
It was a one-hour TV show. It's available on Netflix. You can stream it. It's
she's all over that.
You're right.
Wait till I get home.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. This is really worth seeing. But there is no more... bad, talk about bad films that I love sitting through.
Mm-hmm.
The first wide release of Casino Royale. I mean, Woody Allen, Peter Sellers. It's one of Woody Allen's first directorial efforts, the parts that he did, which are, some of them are hilarious. The John Huston parts are the parts that mostly suck. And there were a lot. There's five directors on that film, because nobody could hold on to it. Everybody lost sight of the movie they were making. But what I think really stunk and was totally unfunny is Austin Powers, which, you know, had a couple of really good lines in it that they did over and over and over again.
Austin Powers is the kind of bad that there is no getting any enjoyment out of whatsoever.
Okay, I'm
like, there's campy bad, there's enjoyable bad, and then there's the kind of bad where you look at it and think, so many other things could have been done with this money.
Yeah. Exactly.
Like, and we could have repaved an interstate, and it would have been a much better use of this money.
I agree. But what it wanted to be and failed totally was Casino Royale, which doesn't have to ape like it's the 60s. It's a 1967 film. It's Herb Albert produced and soundtrack. It's drugs throughout. It's the real thing. Every actor in the Jean-Paul Belmondo is in it. I mean, you know, come on. George Rafton, Jean-Paul Belmondo. How could, you know, outside of Francois Truffaut Dream there, could you get those two people on the same, you know, on the same screen at the same time? But Casino Royale managed it. But I really liked the Daniel Craig film. I thought it was very good, and I'm the one who liked, didn't love, but liked Quantum of Solace.
It was all right.
It was all right. As the second film in a trilogy. And very clearly, we have a trilogy going, which will be the Daniel Craig James Bond trilogy.
In theory.
Well, yeah, except, you know, if MGM can ever, you know.
Yep.
I mean, get a green light. How can you not put a green light on a Bond film?
That's when it's bad. Yeah.
Well.
Like, that's when things are really bad.
No, that's when corporate. I mean, they didn't green light The Hobbit. And they had to get funding elsewhere. And finally, it ended up going to Warner Brothers. And they didn't green light the Bond films, which ain't going nowhere but MGM. So until MGM, you know, figures out its financing.
Daniel Craig will be in Cowboys and Aliens forever.
Yeah. And things like that. It's really bizarre. Should we open this up, by the way?
Oh, by all means. If anyone liked Tron, I would like to talk to them about it. And if they hated Tron, I definitely want to talk to them about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely given short shift to Tron here. I mean, there's plenty more
terrible
things.
We need to get back on topic about such the terrible. As. Oh, God.
Well,
We should give the phone number. I mean, sure. Half the phones are already lighting up. But
okay.
For those people who don't know, it's 212-209-2900. Understand that on Hour of the Wolf, no, I don't practice free speech. I hang up on people who just aren't talking to my guests about the topic that we are speaking of. Sorry, go on.
Before we open the phones, I do want to say, in case anyone is calling because they are rabid Daft Punk fans, the movie works on exactly one level, which is a 2-hour-long Daft Punk music video. Mm-hmm. The music was exquisite. That is not something that we are unhappy with in any respect. Everything else was terrible.
Although I have to say, the music was so good that it was actually even more detrimental to the movie because the movie is so terrible. The visuals and everything that's going on just so completely uninteresting. The music being so good was even made the movie all that more all the more worse by comparison. Although I do have one little slight negative thing about the music in that some of it actually sounded very similar to Inception, and Inception is just so much better of a movie than Tron. It's just like you don't want to be comparing this movie to Inception at all, and like there was some of that Inception music going on, this sort of Hans Zimmer thing going on throughout it.
Is it Hans Zimmer?
No. I mean Inception is.
Inception is.
But you know, I wanted to talk about the original Tron a little bit because, you know, I just watched it, you know, prior, like just right before Christmas because, you know, my family goes to the movies on Christmas every year and we had talked about going to see Tron. And I mean, I was very hesitant because I'd heard nothing but negative reviews at that time. And the only reason.
All of which were true.
Yeah. And I mean, the only reason that I sort of came around is because I saw some other positive reviews from like people. You know, whose opinions I respect. And I was like, I don't really get it. But, so, you know, I was like, let me try to watch the original Tron. I haven't seen it since I was a kid, you know, and
I saw it at Radio City Music Hall. I was surprised that I liked it.
You mean recently or?
No. Oh. I mean opening.
Originally.
I think I actually went as representative of WBAI and Hour of the Wolf, and I had press seats at Radio City Music Hall.
But it wasn't necessarily surprising that you liked it, because even though the effects were dated by the time the movie came out back in 1980, whatever, the ideas behind it were really solid. I mean, it was sort of
But you know what it was? It was a Disney film. And in 1980, the concept of a Disney film being anything but sucks big time wasn't there. This is, Mermaid, there hadn't been a good Disney film in 1980 for over a decade.
And then there was Tron.
And Tron, I think, helped redeem the name. Oh, I take that back. There was one, and the Brave Little Toaster, and the guy who made it got fired from Disney for having made it. His name is John Lasseter, and he now runs Disney Animation and Pixar.
Well, then he ended
and wasn't
up
a great
right.
movie. It wasn't a great movie, but it was written by Tom Dish. Darn it, you know, and directed by John Lasseter. So it was a curious bump in the Disney road.
But Tron, I mean, Tron was. It was Disney optimistic. It was almost like a manifest destiny of what would become the internet mindset, where everyone in the internet is out to help you. And, like, the freedom of information is unabashedly a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to watch it in retrospect here because, you know, I mean, I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. When I saw it as a kid, I'm sure I didn't understand anything about it. But, I mean, it's like it seems, like, really, really forward-looking. I mean, like, it was made in 1982, and it has, like, all these concepts, and it's like, wow, I can't believe, like, this was in a movie in 1982. You know, because it's like, I mean, it's like now that I'm so familiar with computers, it's like, oh, yeah, no, I get this. Like, it's like they got avatars and like, all this other stuff, and it's like it really made sense to me. And it was like, oh, wow, this is pretty sophisticated, you know? And, I mean, the effects are very dated, obviously, but I mean,
but they weren't then. They
right,
really
but I mean,
weren't.
it's still very watchable. I mean, there's a lot of movies that aged badly that are not very watchable anymore, but it really was.
In 1980, I had just gotten my first Atari computer, the Atari 800. Mm-hmm. It was brand new. The 2600 was starting to move. Well, actually, it was still pretty much up there. And the Commodore was about to come out. It hadn't come out yet. I was an Atari person. And so the idea of the Tron, the video game aspect of it, for those who of us of a certain age, was that much more thrilling. I think that you young people could take an easy, you know, it was more like, okay, this is what there is. And it was, you could take a little bit more for granted. For me, you know, who was on BBSs in those days, looking at, you know, we didn't have any such thing as a graphic user interface in those days. The idea was being played with, but few people had actually seen such a thing. Tron was an eye-opening thing, and I don't know how dated the special effects were. I thought they were pretty cool.
They're very obviously of their time, but
but
they're not distracting to the point that you look at it and think this is such a 1982 movie.
Right. Yeah, No, I was just reacting to what you said when you said that they were that the special effects were dated when the movie opened. Oh, what John said.
Oh no, I said they were dated by the time the movie
when it opened.
Yeah, okay, whoever. But and I was just reacting to that thinking, no, I think that was a major step forward actually. Using and also they were really using computer animation in a manner that nobody except Lucasfilm computer was doing, and that became Pixar.
Right.
So really, people weren't doing computer animation well in that era much at all. And when they did, the first big breakthrough was Star Trek II, where Pixar created that whole planet. But what's the name of the effect where the whole movie is about? It's the MacGuffin of the film.
Genesis?
Thank you. Yeah, that was made by Pixar.
Ah.
As a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. And Industrial Light and Magic, which at that time were pretty much this, you know, different divisions of the same company. And that was the first major computer animated thing outside of Tron.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that one of the problems with Tron Legacy is that by now we've seen so many effects in video games and in movies, and we've come so far that seeing a very spectacular, cold CGI landscape doesn't hold a thrill anymore, and the story just could not pick up where the... I mean, if it was spectacular to look at, would it have saved it at all?
I think it would have saved it to some degree, because then it would have at least been this wonderful spectacle to look at. But I mean, the effects aren't even, I mean, for a movie that is so reliant on special effects, they're surprisingly poor, it seems to me. Like, I was not wowed at all. Like, I mean, Avatar was way more interesting visually to look at than Tron. And I mean, I would have thought Tron would be just as good. I mean, if not better, considering that it's basically all about that.
Which is strange, because you can see the money they poured into all of these effects. Yeah. Like, there's, you know, four-level garages made out of glass, and you're purposely, like, you're deliberately not supposed to be able to tell up from down, mm-hmm. and they're, on paper, you can tell that it was a great idea for someone.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened?
So, you know, so here's what I was thinking, like, you know, with the original Tron fresh in my mind, like, so I think the original Tron, I'm not sure, entirely sure that it makes sense. I mean, like, I don't know that all of the metaphors really map to things that, like, mm-hmm. make sense. But it's very interesting, and it leaves you with sort of questions pondering, like, oh, well, what do all these connections mean, and how did this all work? And it sort of, it's like a mystery, but it's intriguing. Tron Legacy has the same problem, but it's just like there's no way any of it makes any sense. It's just a mess. It's like a jumble of nonsense, and it's just like there's no meaning to be found in it at all. And there's nothing like you can map it to. It's like in Tron, like, you know, there was things that you could, like, oh, I can see where these things map to real life. In Tron Legacy, there's nothing like that. It's
a standard dystopia with an enormous special effects budget, only half of which worked.
Okay. I think that's a good quote. That they should put that in the ads.
Yeah, they'll love that.
Genevieve Valentine, WBAI Radio. It works. It really does. Okay. And if you would like, by the way, to talk on WBAI Radio with Genevieve Valentine and John Joseph Adams, what movie is it I was watching in which...
Forbidden Planet?
Yes. Okay, now I don't have to say...
I'm psychic! Wow!
That was amazing. That was amazing that you picked. No, because it was on just like, you know, three or four nights ago as part of, I guess, either the Anne Francis and or mm-hmm. Leslie Nielsen Movie Festival.
I assumed where you were going is because you were talking about my name, and there's Commander John J. Adams in Forbidden Planet.
Exactly.
And, do you get that a lot?
I don't, actually, and I'm really surprised that I don't.
And they call him JJ in a couple of scenes.
Yeah. Right, you know, well, because, I mean, working in science fiction, like,
you think
I was in the field, like, I don't know, probably 6 or 7 years before anyone brought that up to me. And, I mean, I get the president thing all the time. Like, oh, like, you know, is your middle name Quincy? It's like, no, it's Joseph. It's right there.
I asked you on the air if you were at all related to, like, William Daniels or Paul Giamatti or something like
that. Yeah. You know, I mean, people ask that, like, you know, fairly often. But, like, no, almost no one ever says the John J. Adams thing.
Oh,
Alan Steele, I believe, was the first person to ever do it. And he actually apologized for doing so because he thought that everyone does it.
And
so
when Matthew Kressel met Lister, who's on the air at 3 o'clock, with Burn Baby Burn Clappers, he said, that have anything to do with Red Dwarf? Well, think about it, man, right? You know, it's like, yeah, okay. Well, what's the name of the guy of the Charles, Craig Charles or something like that, who plays Lister in Red Dwarf? Do you know who plays Lister in Red Dwarf?
Me.
Yeah, you, Lister. That was one of the you see all those records over there. He produced all those. It's very impressive, actually. Yes.
No, I used to run Island Records. That's all. I get no credit for it.
That's just it. Just used to run Island Records. Yeah. Never mind. That's a minor thing. Minor. You know, you move here and Sean Penn moves there. You know.
Yep. I heard he's going to be the ambassador to the United States to Venezuela. Right?
Oh my God! No. He said that he's moving to Haiti for the rest of his life.
Great.
Sean Penn, in all seriousness.
That's great.
Which, you know, I think it's probably a good thing. Okay. 212-209-2900. By the way, I'm looking at the list of Skiffy movies
mm-hmm.
coming out in mm-hmm. next year. And the idea of Thor, directed by Kenneth Branagh.
Okay. If anyone can take Thor and make it the best Canfest of the year, it's going to be Kenneth Branagh.
Thank you for pronouncing it correctly.
Perhaps intentionally. But anyone who saw his version of Frankenstein knows that that guy is the master of unintentionally cracking you up.
Yeah, I know. But you know what? Another film that should have been wonderful and just didn't. Now, he didn't direct it, but he was one of the bigger problems in it. The Wild Wild West.
We will not speak of the Wild Wild West.
Okay, so
Tron Legacy is better than Wild Wild West.
Oh my God! Yeah, well, yeah. I haven't seen Tron Legacy.
They're remaking the TV show now too with Ron Moore at the helm.
Oh well, Ron
Moore.
He needed
something else to mess up.
Well, it'll be awesome the whole thing, and then he'll ruin it in the last episode.
and he'll leave halfway through.
Wait, did he leave?
Well, he left Carnival.
Oh, okay, right.
He did
right.
the first season of Carnival, and it was supposed to be an ongoing, solid mm-hmm. story, and he left that. Mm-hmm. And, Battlestar
Thingies. It's J.J. Abrams syndrome.
And speaking of J.J. Abrams, mm-hmm. the movie Super 8, opening on June 10th. Mm-hmm. Do you know about this? This is his homage to Steven Spielberg.
I do know that.
And on IO9, mm-hmm. their description is J.J. Abrams directed this tribute to Steven Spielberg, featuring a mysterious creature that we only glimpsed in the teaser trailer. Already speculation and probably fake concept are circulating on what the creature will look like. I just figure the creature will probably just say Elliot or, you know, something like that. So, good day, WBAI. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi, Jim.
Hi there.
Just get my radio. Okay, hi.
And Genevieve and John are there.
Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hi.
Are all films on the table here, or?
Yeah.
Anything off? Okay, I'm not doing anything, illegal here, so.
If you hear a dial tone, you know I didn't approve.
And I'm not going to petition for free speech. I totally believe in your dictatorship. So
thank you.
Get that on the table, too.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
If you like dictatorships, you should enjoy my anthology, Brave New Worlds, then. So.
Okay, I'll look into that.
Just a little plug there.
Just published by Nightshade Books, of course.
All right.
But you should contact their publicist. Oh, John's also the publicist.
We can segue to the real Hour of the Wolf, but that's okay.
yeah. Except Esther will be on before that.
So I saw a film a couple of weeks ago that was going on PBS. I had seen as a kid at a drive-in and by the Jersey Shore many, many, many years ago. And the night they ate at Minsky's, and I thought this is a really incredible flick. I saw it as a kid, and I thought it was kind of campy and funny and all that.
Ah, but when you saw it as a kid, remember, it had really interesting nudity.
Yeah, and it was rated M, which was kind of funny, that archaic rating that doesn't exist. And Britt Eklund's eyes just, could power the music.
They're so round. You don't know this movie. I'm looking at John and Genevieve, and they're pulling a blank.
You were looking at her
sorry,
eyes.
Elliot Gould mm-hmm. in one of his first roles ever.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good film. I really liked it. I don't know if it holds up as well today, but I saw it not that long ago.
What's the title?
The Night They Raided Minsky's.
No, they say that was the last film that Bert Lahr was in, and he didn't even finish it. He died.
That's right. He died during the filming of it. Yeah, it's about the invention of burlesque.
Well, there you go.
Mm.
Yeah, and do you know, is that film based on, because I haven't researched it much, what is it a book, is that an original screenplay?
It was an original screenplay. It was mildly, it was based on fact insofar as there had been recollections by a few people who had worked at Minsky's and stuff like that. But, not the story of the Amish girl who becomes the world's first stripper, no. That part is just fiction. But, Elliot Gould's first film, at the time he was still married to Barbara Streisand.
Okay.
Which is still something that sort of boggles the mind, the marriage of Elliot Gould and Barbara Streisand. Joel Grey was in it, as I recall.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Joel Grey was in it.
Yeah. And
a gentleman who died not too long, I forget his name. He played a sort of clownish act.
Norman Wisdom.
Yeah, there you go.
Norman Wisdom is in it.
He seems to have been a really interesting sort of person, and he played the role of the frustrated flunky who isn't as attractive, but he had the moral rectitude at the end. They showed that Jason Robards' character was a rogue.
And Jason Robards, of course. Yeah, how can I not mention Jason Robards? Bad movies are worth seeing because they have Jason Robards in it.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned, but...
Actually, one more quick thing, because I want to...
Directed by William Friedkin.
Oy.
I'm just looking it up. Oh my God! You know, from that to The Exorcist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I just want to quickly comment. Have any of you seen? And this is a total switch. Truffaut's Le Chambre Verte.
Which is the title?
Le Chambre Verte, the Green Room. I know that sounds like something else, but.
Yeah.
Is that part of the trilogy with the Green Lantern and the Green Hornet?
No, I
no.
Nice.
I'm ashamed because I'm a big Truffaut fan.
Yeah.
You know, and you're talking on a radio show that's named after an obscure Ingmar Bergman film. But I don't know that film.
Okay. I'll just leave it there because I don't want to hog the forum here. So you guys have a good night.
Is this a film you recommend?
Well, I saw it a long time ago, and I recommend it, but I remember distinctly sitting in the theater and being pissed off because, I can say this all right, a couple of people next...
No, you can't say pissed off.
This is a pretentious French kind of thing, and I wanted to strangle them because I was moved by it. I don't remember much of what it was about. It was, you know, a bunch of years ago, and I was in an altered universe to some degree, but it had a beautiful kind of... I had never seen anything like it before. It had its own sort of rhythm and pace that was something I hadn't seen before.
It's Truffaut, you know. Auteur. Yeah. It's
I got really angry that these guys were meddling with my little spiritual moment there, and I came ever so close to saying some choice words, you know. But part of me.
By the way, let me just mention, because I'm looking it up, other people in the night they rated Minsky's Denham Elliott, Jack Burns, Forrest Tucker, for God's sake.
Forrest Tucker.
Wonderful performances.
Agard wasn't in it, though.
No. Listen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Have a good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio. Yellow.
Hello.
Hi there, how are you?
I just want to echo what Genevieve said about Tron Legacy's writing, because I saw that and it did feel like the writers were just cutting and pasting lines from every movie they'd ever seen, but out of context. Sort of
it did. It was like a party game that got violently out of control.
And
reminds me of a game they played at ReaderCon.
I actually got excited about this film because the trailer from Comic-Con that before mm-hmm. they even greenlit it was mm-hmm. so cool looking, and it was good action. It was exciting. It had a dark, menacing feel to it. It actually felt like the original Tron.
Mm.
And then trailer number two was really good too. And the Daft Punk was used in the trailers perfectly to underscore the action.
Yep.
But it wasn't in the actual movie. It was actually sort of out of context, the music.
It was a dirty trick to get you into the theater.
Yeah.
Well, so was the action. I mean, all the action must have been in the trailer. There's hardly any action in the movie.
But the original, I've seen the trailer that he's talking about, and there was a sense of, like, dystopia and energy and there was actually a lot of action in the movie. Like, they hardly ever stopped moving, except when they were in the horrible, like, Buddhist crash pad. But none of the energy translated.
Yeah, there
so
you go.
Lots of action.
So how do you think
energy.
This will compare? I'm looking again at IO9 to the live action version of the Smurfs.
We are not going to talk about the live action version of the Smurfs.
With may I point out, Hank Azaria and Neil Patrick Harris.
I have no comment. Let's talk more about the Tron trailer.
Yeah, well, the second Tron trailer actually gave the impression that there was going to be this cool chess match between Clue and Kevin Flynn,
right?
Yep.
The old man. And in the movie itself, no such thing. The trailer lied. He's just like this passive old.
Trailers use outtakes. No, that's true. That's true because they don't know what the final cut is going to be when they make the trailer.
Right.
But I mean, he was an old hippie who had to be knocked out of his. You know, despicable torpor by his crazy son. It was just It was just pointless. We should have known. I went to the movie before I checked. I just fell in love with the idea of it and went before I checked.
I
should have checked on IMDb because I would have found out that Kitsis and Horowitz, the main writers, are ex Lost writers. So. And that's what we've got coming for Cowboys and Aliens, by the way.
Now, Jay,
Orky and Kurtzman from the Star Trek movie.
I think that J.J. Abrams has a lot to answer for.
Hold out much hope for Cowboys and Aliens.
But how can you make a bad movie with Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig? And the answer is, I guess we'll find out.
Mm-hmm. Well, how could you make a bad movie with Jeff Bridges? Well,
there have been several.
Okay.
There have been several. There is not a member of that family that has not made a bad film, starting with the father, way including Bo, you know. Absolutely. You know, so, the landlord, anybody?
If you like the new Star Trek, well, you're going to get more of it in Cowboys and Aliens. That's all I'm going to say.
I agree.
Okay. I don't know why I was so set to despise it, but I did like the new Star Trek.
After all those New Generation movies, it was a little bit more lively.
You see the problem. Of course, I was always a Patrick Stewart, type. Oh. And by the way, has the blogosphere noticed, how likely is it that the number two on the Enterprise was likely to make, scatological and sexist films? I think, either Enterprise that would have applied. You've been following this in the news, no?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Yeah. Did you have something to...
Not at all.
Oh, not at all. You didn't like Star Trek? The reboot.
The reboot?
Yeah.
No.
You did not? Okay.
No, not remotely.
I was all set to despise it, and I thought they did a rather good job. There are a number of bets that they missed on it. I know why some of those bets were missed, but I'm not a big J.J. Abrams fan, but I thought they did a good job.
And you're welcome to.
Well, you see, you're not an old time Trekkie, are you?
She's a next generation girl.
I object to that remark. I started with Next Generation, but I backfilled Star Trek as soon as I could.
Next Gen is my favorite. Yeah, okay. Next Gen is my favorite.
No, we can agree on that.
Okay.
We're all Next Generation
Okay, very
people.
Good. Very okay. good. Take that, Ordover. You know that John Ordover, the owner of the gallery where I do the readings, mm-hmm. was the editor of the Star Trek books for Pocket Books, right?
Oh, fun. I did not know that.
You didn't know that, yeah. There you go. So he's got a lot to answer for. Greg Cox, Keith DeCandido. He hired a lot of good writers. A lot of good writers got excellent work mm-hmm. for hire. Churning those out, it's a great stuff to do while you're to make some money while you're trying to write your serious work.
Yeah, you need to get in on that action. They're still doing them, aren't they?
Work for hires? Absolutely.
No, I mean, they're still doing those Star Trek novels.
No, they're not.
Oh, they're not. Okay.
So. I
thought they still were, because why? The brand is still alive. I mean, there's no reason to.
But the Doctor is in.
Huh?
The Doctor Who novels. Things,
oh, yeah. So we don't have to talk about that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Star Trek novel.
Michael Moorcock just published a Doctor Who mm-hmm. novel, may I point out. Michael Moorcock has written some pretty bad stuff. I don't know about this Doctor Who thing.
Snap.
But indeed. Good morning. You're on the radio. Well, no, you're a dial tone.
That was
morning.
Michael Moorcock.
You're on the radio.
Hey, Jim.
Hi there. How are you?
My absolute favorite subject is bad movies.
Welcome.
Let me do a quick rundown. Any movie that's not Sean Connery, the first five, that's what you need to watch. And then going down, I would say Timothy Dalton in License to Kill. Then George Lazenby. Then... Diamonds Are Forever, which is the worst Sean Connery one.
It's the lowest Sean Connery one, but it's not that bad.
I would say Pierce Bronson, amazingly, is the better Bond.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was just watching a Roger Moore movie yesterday, Spy Loved Me, and I was thinking, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. I couldn't believe how bad it was.
It's terrible.
And how sexist it
Actually,
was. And the problem with
Moonraker is much worse.
Yeah, I was going to say, is anything worse than Moonraker?
No.
The problem with James Bond is that past the 60s, or the early 70s even, it like is completely outdated. And I agree with the Austin Powers kind of syndrome. It was like, that was the worst thing I ever saw. I saw the first movie, and I thought it was
People
really
have to
bad.
Remember that Bond itself is a parody. It's a spoof. Well, it started as Dr. No was a spoof.
World War II propaganda. So the Cold War is basically over in the 70s.
The book's written in the 50s.
Yeah.
Okay, it started in the 50s. Dr. No is 1960, what, 3, 2, thereabouts.
Right.
So, no, it is of its time. But when Roger Moore took it over, and that's already after they've done spoofs on
Good
spoofs, Our Man Flint and all that stuff.
Really
I was a kid when the spoofs on spoofs were coming out. I was of the age when Dr. No came out. I was 11. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Well, I went to a Bond stage. The first time I actually saw it was on TV, and it was the first, it was like the perfect night of TV. After the UFO, remember that show?
Yes.
Okay, it was James Bond, which I've never seen in my life. It was Goldfinger.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw, let's see, You Only Live Twice, which is my absolute favorite, and Thunderball in the theater.
Roald Dahl wrote You Only Live Twice,
my God,
that helps.
It was the best. But let me roll along because there's not much time. My absolute favorite spy spoofs, and forget about Austin Powers, is Le Magnifique with Jean-Paul Belmondo.
Oh, my God, yes.
And another movie called Road to Corinth.
Okay, but spy spoofs, Jean-Paul Belmondo, don't forget That Man from Rio.
Yeah, well, Magnifique is better because he's kind of Walter Mitty. He's writing about a spy, and he kind of lives them out.
See, I hardly remember
this horrible life where it's like, you know, the roof is leaking, his wife is leaving him, and then all of a sudden he's like the super spy, and he goes through the thing like he actually kills the character kind of like they kill Sherlock Holmes, and everyone's in an uproar of how he kills him, and it's just really, really, really good. And my favorite... worst movie of all time, it never fails to be entertaining, is called A Certain Fury. Are you familiar with that?
No, it sounds familiar.
Oh, my God.
No.
It's Tatum O'Neill and Irene Cara, and I swear to God, it's a horrible, horrible movie. If you literally goes right into the sewers the first 10 minutes and explodes.
Tatum O'Neill after she was.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's like Peter Fonda slashing the face of Tatum O'Neill. It's a sleazy drug-induced kind of nightmare.
Not good enough to be Roger Corman.
In the hard streets of some nameless Canadian city. It's, like, really bizarre. And she plays, Tatum O'Neill plays a character named Scarlet, and they're wrongly accused, and they're just, like, being hunted down by every policeman in the world kind of thing. And they're running around the sewers, and they have to go to Peter Fonda, who's a pimp, who, like, ends up slashing her face. It's really bad. It's directed by Maggie and Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh,
which is probably an explanation by why there's so much cocaine being done in this movie. It is really the worst movie. It's out of print. If you can ever get a copy of it, that's the one.
With their parents
and there's
or
also
something?
A book called Bad Movies We Love. I forget who, by Margulies and some other guy. There's a whole chapter just on Patrick Swayze and Sharon Stone movies. And I think Patrick Swayze's
I think you could do a book.
Point Break by Kathryn Bigelow.
Yeah.
Probably the worst one. More Dudes Per Minute. And it also has Keanu Reeves as a surfer FBI agent.
Yes, I know that one.
And they're robbing the banks in President Matz, and it has More Dudes Per Minute. It's just like completely, it's like dude.
Yeah,
whole movie.
You know a movie that's always gotten a bad rap, and I think I'm the only one who liked it, is Kathryn Bigelow film, is the one with Ralph Fiennes.
Strange Days.
Strange
Days. One of my
days.
Favorite science fiction movies. Yeah. I will go to the mat
oh
for Strange
God,
Days.
Oh, my God, you and I agree on this.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. I'm sorry?
Did you see Siesta?
No.
Is that what it's called? With she's stunt woman and she goes into a volcano and it's like.
Is this a Kathryn Bigelow one or just
a
bad movie?
It's her follow up to from Point Break, I think.
Huh.
And it's like one of my favorite movies. It's also in that.
Was
movie,
she still married
like
to Cameron then? Was
that
the
I like that one, I guess, because it was like really bizarre. It had Grace Jones in it and Jodie Foster and Julian Sands.
I'm in. That's like the trifecta.
Julian Sands and who's the most handsomest guy in the world? I forget. He's old now, but he was a Cuban actor. I'm just like really spacing out his name. It has a whole
Ricardo Montalban,
Alan Barkin. No,
no Cuban.
He was in Untouchables. Andy Garcia.
Ah,
or maybe it's somebody else. Ah, at this point.
Right now, Julian Sands is crying that he wasn't the handsome.
All right, but you never saw Certain Fury. That's the worst. That's the absolute worst. And
yeah,
I
but you see, you're talking. Yeah, okay.
I must say, I like the Blood Island trilogy, the Filipino horror movies. Are you familiar with
when
those?
When it comes to horror, I remove myself from
the
pool.
Oh, you got to see the Filipino.
No, and I'm actually the same way.
Mad Doctor Blood Island.
I like good horror movies, interesting horror movies, like, for example, Hour of the Wolf.
The monster comes in and pulls his own head off. It's ridiculous. And everyone's running around in grass skirts and fighting each other and like running around in a Filipino jungle. And there's a whole bunch of movies that just seems like made $20 to make, but it was so much fun. I remember watching them on Channel 9. And I have a couple of them here, so.
Oh, when Chris Steinbrenner was still the programmer.
Yeah.
At Channel 9.
Let me recommend some good ones, because you know I'm good for that.
Oh, yes, I do, as a matter
Immortal?
Of fact. Say what?
Immortal is a good science fiction movie. It has a lot
James
of CGI.
Gunn.
It's much better than Tron. It looks like a heavy, it's based on heavy metal comic.
Oh,
like,
so it's not the James
Fifth
Gunn
Element
one.
And it's, I forget the artist, but it has like all these Egyptian like kind of, futuristic New York with a pyramid floating on top, turning into a giant tree. I can't even explain.
I haven't heard anybody even mention Skyline.
That's what I'm saying. A lot of things, you know, go under the radar. And I still have to recommend Saragossa Manuscript if you guys have never seen it. Spirits of the Dead if you've never seen it. And what's the other one? Oh, Splinter. Talk about monster movies that they don't make. That's a real good one. It's like these carjackers take these yuppies and they're kind of stranded in a gas station by God knows what. Mm-hmm. It's really good. Splinter. That's a good monster movie. And I'll shut up now.
Okay, we have to move on.
Get off the phone. That's enough.
Thank you.
Process.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, now we have, 4 minutes left. So.
Did he say Maggie and Jake Gyllenhaal directed that movie?
That's what I heard, but it's really early in the morning. Maybe we were mistaken.
Yeah, no, we must have misheard.
Okay.
I was like, did he mean their parents or something?
I don't know. I mean, because they don't seem old enough.
Well, no. I mean, he was talking about an old movie, right?
And that he directed. That they directed.
Yeah.
Well, I know, not ancient,
you know,
but, you know, 80s
Tatum,
or
if Tatum O'Neill is old enough to get her face slashed by the Peter Fonda pimp, then we're talking about something that was made in the last, 8 years?
Mm.
It's possible that they could have done it. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm just saying it's entirely possible that Sci-Fi paid them $10. They went to Vancouver. They made a movie.
Yeah, that actually is quite possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I'd forgotten that possible scenario.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go that route. We haven't even mentioned, like, you know, the Princess of Mars that they did.
That was amazing.
Wasn't that, my God. And before the Pixar version came out, comes out, which is, I think, is that 2013?
No, 2012.
2012?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Oh, so they must actually be moving along.
It's like the 100-year anniversary.
Ah, is that what it is? Okay. And that one, that's going to be, it's Andrew Stanton directing,
yep,
I believe.
Yep, the director of WALL-E.
Yes,
yep.
Exactly. WALL-E. That's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, that one might be genuinely good.
Yeah, it could be. But it would be a first. They've made that film, 8 times?
Yeah, but it's Pixar, though. So, I mean,
exactly.
I mean, they, you know, almost are always good.
So. Almost? What?
Except for Cars.
I haven't
which they
seen
made
Cars.
A sequel
Cars
to.
Isn't great. Cars
I haven't
isn't
seen
great,
Cars,
still
but I've heard
not
that,
that
it's
bad.
Yeah.
And
I'm not,
comparatively,
I'm not saying it's,
not
saying it's terrible. I'm saying they knocked it out of the park, and also there was Cars.
Okay. I buy that.
Okay.
John, you are leaving New York.
I am.
You'll be back.
I mean, sure,
visits
I'll come to visit,
and things like that, and you'll be on the show again.
Yeah.
But you know, John has been a font for readings.
Wisdom.
Sans serif.
there we go. No, that's
sorry,
a, that's,
3 a.m. joke.
No,
I'm sorry.
That's a typeface. You're trying to typeface people.
Oh.
We don't stereotype or typeface people.
I'm sorry.
But it's WBAI. We don't stereotype. Yes, we do. Anyway, many NERSIF readings have been fabulous because of your input. Not only the ones that you hosted on Mythologies, but he booked for me Paolo Bacigalupi, which I would say is, you know, moderately wow. And we will miss you, except for the fact that we trust you're going to be visiting every so often. And you'll also be in touch because you can still cause me to book people,
mm-hmm.
both on the show and in the NERSIF reading series, right?
Yep. Yeah, I'll be in touch, and you know, I'll be back to visit and whatnot. So
very good. The current newest anthology is Brave New Worlds from Nightshade Books, and Genevieve. Your novel is called
Mécanique, a tale of the Circus Trisalti.
Right. Yeah, and I have heard 2 readings now that Genevieve has done from that novel, one at Capclave and one at, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings.
Mm-hmm.
And all I can say is everybody, yeah. But your short stories, I hope you continue them.
Thank you. I hope so too.
I am such a fan of great short stories because for me, you know, those are the gems. Those are the things that tie it all together. But the novel is coming out in May.
Correct.
And if I am here, so shall you be.
Done.
Okay. Done but deal. We also have to do this more often. I mean, in the new time that is Hour of the Wolf, we have to figure out, you know, I don't yet fully have the rhythm, but I do know that it's going to be a little bit more free form like this morning has been. I had no idea what we were going to do. Didn't know we were going to even mention movies.
You had me on. You knew you were going to mention movies.
Well, yeah, but we might be talking about writing or, you know, who knows what. So, you know, listeners, be warned. Oh, very important announcement. Last week I asked listeners to send out positive energy and very good thoughts about Margot Adler. And let me just say it appears to have worked. She's well. So, you know, we're all taking a nice deep breath over that. Thank you, Genevieve Valentine, whose website is
GenevieveValentine.com.
And John Joseph Adams, whose podcast is The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy, and JohnJosephAdams.com.
Mm-hmm.
Who'd have thunk it?
And you can find Geek's Guide at IO9, or if you just go to geeksguideshow.com, it has information about all the different episodes.
And it's on iTunes, isn't it?
Yep. You can subscribe through iTunes.
And there will be an Hour of the Wolf podcast coming real soon now. So thank you all for listening. Stay tuned for Burn, Baby, Burn! Clappers. coming your way in low these few minutes. I'll be back next week with this program, and you know what? I don't know what I'm doing. But, hey, that's always been true. Good morning.
Deixa o gás. 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 De press time. 3 o'clock on the docket. Burn, baby, burn. This is it. This is your Friday. This is your Saturday. This is your Sunday. This is your weekend. 99 Cinco. Birthday. Last week, Jim Front. I heard somebody
burn,
say.
Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah, yeah.
Imperialist Inferno. Burn, baby, burn.
99 Cinco.
I heard somebody say. Burn, baby, burn.
Yeah.
Imperialist Inferno. Burn, baby, burn.
List alive. Duh-duh.
Burn it.
You're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org. Yo, Felipe Luciana sitting in for Esther, 6 o'clock. Yo, lick it back on 8 o'clock with Amy Goodman, more political than ever. Yes, I am. Al Jazeera at 5 o'clock. So we'll do it on a Thursday, starting off with Robert Knight, Jim Fry, Misty Hoodlow, Burn Baby Burn. This is Lister Hugh and Lowe every Thursday, 6 o'clock. Esther comes in right after Al Jazeera, which kicks in at 5 o'clock. The burn, baby, burn thing where we no smoke nothing medical, just strictly hydroponic, sensimina, ganja, lamb's red. Yes, I am. Mazel tov. 5 on a Thursday, WSB 9.1 FM on a Sabbath, 12 noon until 3 o'clock when Felix Palazzo comes in. So we do it. Liquid Sound Lounge on a Sabbath. Yeah, Jeannie Harper on the case. 99.5, List Alive. From the movie, The Harder They Come. G. genius icon, Jimmy Cliffs. True story about Ivan. Perry Hensel, the genius. This is Jimmy Cliff back in the days. Listen.
If the burden gets you down, pressure is all around. You sit around and hesitate. Say you wait for that lucky break. Life's for living. Better use your sensor. Use what you got from coincidence.
Winston Brennan on drums. Yo, Garland Jeffries' favorite drummer, Winston Brennan on drums. Garland Jeffries' favorite keyboard player, Gladstone Anderson. Garland Jeffries' favorite artist, Jimmy Cliff.
Sooner or later, you'll have to be the one you are. Or you just might find that you're out of time and you're just too late.
if I follow my mind, I never go wrong. I wanna sing that song. It wouldn't take so long. Never, never could do wrong. Hey, hey, if I follow my heart, I'd live by emotions in my every notion. It will lead me astray now, each and every day now. Hey, hey, if I follow my heart.
Warwick, New York, this is for you.
My mind is a fine mind.
Middletown, New York, this is for you.
My mind is a right mind. My mind is a clear mind.
Newburgh.
Clear mind.
Burn, baby, burn, Charlie, Newburgh. This is for you, y'all. 29 degrees on the outside. Lista on the inside.
It takes so long. Never, never could do wrong. Hey, hey, if I follow my